The Right to Question is supported in part by the Paul Allen Family Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
What was Lori's winter job in Yellowstone National Park?
Lori was our next door neighbor, and her job was to shovel the roofs of the Park Service buildings in the lake area.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Marjane Ambler about her book Yellowstone Has Teeth, a memoir of living year-round in the world's first national park. You lived year-round in Yellowstone for 9 years because of your husband's job as a heavy equipment operator. What was it like where you were?
Well, I like to say that we had long blocks of uninterrupted time where my only interruption was a swan's shadow across my computer screen. That was the good part. The other part was that we learned that mistakes matter, that you don't do anything foolish when you're living under those conditions. And so I found it interesting to probe my neighbors' lives and emotions to find out how they were dealing with the danger and the boredom.
And you're talking about the danger of living in a place where, for instance, you have to ride a snowmobile 30 miles to get to the nearest store or restaurant. You have to really pay attention to what's around you in order not to die. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, actually. I mean, we were going over a avalanche-prone pass to get to our car, which was another 50 miles to get to the grocery store. So the risk of avalanche, the risk of going through bison herds, the risk of breaking down, your snow machine breaking down. And at one point, I had to walk off Sylvan Pass by myself in the dark. And some things were perceived risks, and some things were very genuine risks.
And we'll come back to some of those risks in a minute. But first, just talk about where you lived specifically. Was it a village? Was it a cabin?
Well, we imagined that we would live in a little log cabin off in the woods, but in fact, we lived in a community of 12 in a quadruplex, and it was located near the north shore of Yellowstone Lake, kind of between Fishing Bridge and the Lake Hotel, in the center of the park.
And that was housing specifically for people who lived there?
Yeah. Some of your listeners may not know that there's no private housing in the park at all. It's either housing for Park Service employees or concession employees.
And so because it's government housing in a park and not a lot of people ever see those, I didn't get the idea that it was very glamorous housing. Sometimes it didn't even have the basics of what you really needed to be comfortable.
Yeah. That's true.
I remember one passage about a propane refrigerator.
It got a lot better by the time we were there, but the people that we interviewed, their house burned down because of a kerosene refrigerator. Their house was also the ranger station. And so it varied a lot over the years. We thought we were roughing it until we started interviewing some of these people that lived there in the 30s and the 50s and found out that they were real pioneers.
Well, there's kind of a reason for those bachelor-type housing situations, I guess, because at first the Park Service didn't expect women to really be there, right?
The Park Service didn't expect women to be there and didn't want women to be there.
There was a time when some of the Park Service rangers were women, but tell us what happened to them and what happened to the idea of hiring women.
Yeah, that was one of the most fascinating things that in the history was that the first superintendent, Horace Albright, was very much interested in hiring women because he said that the male rangers that he had at the time, they were outdoor people. They were not good at communicating with the public. And he thought it was very important back in the 20s to attract people to the national parks. And, of course, that's not the problem we face now, but at that time, he thought that that was important. And so he hired the country's first female ranger. And then some inspector from Washington, D.C., who was more old school, and he thought that women just spoiled the whole image of a ranger, a Park Service ranger. And he just was very critical. And the National Park Service said that women would not be hired anymore.
And then how many years was it until they began to be hired again?
You know, I can't remember exactly, but it was decades.
I think it was the 60s, maybe.
Yeah.
So back to the housing, because these places were built kind of as bachelor pads, they didn't really accommodate families very well until women rangers started being there. It seemed like the Park Service expected a man to just be away from his family for however many months he was working in the winter.
Yeah, and the summer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they just didn't want women around. Of course, some of the men were fire lookouts and at remote locations that were remote even in the summer.
Some of the small chores that you had to do when you lived in Yellowstone Park in the winter became monumental because of the weather and because of the distance and because you had to ride snow machines that were squirrely, sometimes would break down, as you mentioned before. So describe what it was like just to go get a load of groceries.
Well, we learned a lot from our neighbors about how to get a load of groceries. But when we first were there, Terry was always over-prepared. So we had a gas can with us, and we had our skis in case we broke down. And it's all packed on the same sled with the groceries. So one time we were coming over Sylvan Pass, and it was particularly rough conditions. There had been a storm through, and Terry, whose job it was to make it smooth, had not groomed that road that day.
He drove the big machine that smashed down the snow so that people could snowmobile on it.
Yeah, yeah. His job was grooming the roads from Lake Village in all the directions, including Sylvan Pass. So we arrived at our quadruplex, and we pulled back the tarp, and it was a mess. There was gasoline mixed in with broken milk that had spouted out of the plastic milk jugs and swirled around and soaked through the cardboard boxes. So the only thing left to eat was really the canned goods.
There was one scene in the book where a couple rode snowmobiles with an infant in freezing temperatures, I believe it was the middle of winter, through avalanche country. Yikes.
Yeah, the people that had small children had it so much more challenging. I mean, they'd have to pack the crib and all the kids' clothing and diapers, and they'd have to get their earplugs in, and depending on their age, their goggles and helmets, and then they had to worry about Well, do you strap the baby to you, the toddler to you, or so that if you have a wreck that the toddler will fall off with you, or would it be better for the child to go flying through the air separately?
Yeah, because you might fall on them.
Yeah.
And one of the really major hazards on those roads were the bison, because at night you couldn't see them, and during the day they might be covered with snow. So you had some harrowing experiences. Tell us why they would be on the road in the first place.
Well, it was really interesting. One of those things that you didn't know necessarily if you were just traveling through the park, but they're naturally nomadic. But when they want to find better pastures, greener pastures, they would use the roads because it took a lot less energy. And in fact, there were thousands more bison because it was easier for them to move and find better pastures.
You mean their numbers increased?
Yes, over the decades from the time that they started grooming. And so the snow off the road would be at least belly deep. Often they would be making trenches as high as my waist. And it took a lot of energy to do that.
And so when they could walk on those roads, they're probably like any other creature, take the easiest path of least resistance.
Yeah.
Was there something about the isolation and the challenges of living in the backcountry of Yellowstone that appealed to you, something in particular?
Well, the long blocks of uninterrupted time are attractive to any rider, and I enjoyed that. I love skiing. I average 100 days of skiing out my back door per year. I think that any place where you live in isolation, you are insulated from the day-to-day problems of your family that are outside the park. You don't get as involved in all the drama of your circle. And of course, we didn't get involved with the drama of national politics or international. It seemed a little bit further away, even though we had radio reception most of the time we lived there.
I remember you saying that your usual morning routine was to listen to NPR and drink a cup of tea, but during the summer fires of 1988, you even stopped doing that because there was so much drama going on around you.
I didn't need that extra adrenaline.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Marjane Ambler about Yellowstone Has Teeth, a memoir of living year-round in the world's first national park. We'll be back shortly to hear a passage from the book and some stories about tourist-wildlife interactions. Don't go away. Well, unlike some of the other women who were living in the park, as we mentioned, you had your career, a portable career. You can write anywhere, and so you were able to take that with you. You had no small children, but there were many younger people working there, including Lori, who was at the time, I think, in her early 20s. People who needed social outlets, who needed to be around other people their own age, and people who had young children. So talk a little bit about what it was like for them to, you know, just try to go be with other people, or what did they do if a child got sick and there was a blizzard and they needed a doctor?
Yeah. Well, I'll start with Lori. Lori initially was very lonely because she didn't have a Park Service radio. She didn't have any pets. She didn't really have people her own age, as you had mentioned. And so it took her a while to adjust to that kind of existence. But during the summer, she was the social director informally, and she would organize all kinds of activities for us. And during the winter, she took on that role as well. But she got out every weekend when she could to visit friends in the outside world. For the people that had small children, any of us were quite vulnerable if in case of a medical emergency. There was one woman that had a miscarriage, and she had to snowmobile out to go talk to the doctor afterwards. There was a story that's not in the book that I heard recently where a guy had a burst appendix and he had to snowmobile out.
Yikes. That's something that's even painful to think about.
Yeah. And you had asked about the small children. That, of course, the parents were most worried about medical emergencies involving their children. The one couple that we interviewed down at the south entrance, their neighbor's boy fell off the roof. But fortunately, there was a deep snow and he wasn't injured. There was another young boy who his parents transferred to North Dakota, and they worked at Theodore Roosevelt National Park. And he came down with the life-threatening childhood croup, and they rushed him to the hospital. If it had been at Lake, they don't know whether he would have made it.
Because Lake was too much farther into the interior.
Yeah. From Lake, they would have had to go by snowmobile to the nearest medical help would be 50 miles, whereas in North Dakota, they were able to drive to the hospital.
Mm. Well, as we mentioned, with the summer fires of 1988, winter isn't the only time that Yellowstone has teeth. And I remember some stories that you wrote, particularly about a family that was living in a backcountry cabin. Tell us why they were there and how they had to get out, how they ran from that fire. I mean, just the idea that they're there where there are forest fires burning all around them, so the sky's full of smoke, and they've got like a radio to communicate with headquarters.
Yeah, that's Kathleen O'Leary and Dave Phillips, and he was the thoroughfare ranger. And the thoroughfare is as far as I know, the most isolated ranger station in the lower 48, and perhaps one of the most isolated places a person can live, 30 miles from the nearest road by horseback. But when the reason they were there is because he watches for poachers and tracks what the wildlife are doing, maintains trails. And his children were there for several summers as well. When the fires got the worst, the kids had already left the park and gone back home to their mother. But they had their horses to get out. And they had always assumed that a helicopter could rescue them, the people. But then they found out the helicopters were so busy that summer that they couldn't count on that at all. And of course, they felt a deep responsibility to their horses. So by the time that they had to leave, there was fire on both sides of the trail, and they couldn't go the shorter 30-mile route. They had to go a longer route, and in fact, they had to do some bushwhacking along the way just to find a trail that wasn't burning at the moment.
Yeah, it was a harrowing scene where they're trying to get through and they can't see because of the smoke, and there are pieces of burning wood falling all around them. And you devote many of these, the pages in this book, to the animals. We already talked a little bit about the bison, but also the bears. And one story you wrote was about a bear that was killed simply because a museum in California wanted a bear.
Yeah, I think most of your listeners realize that park management policies in our whole national attitude toward wildlife has changed radically over the decades. And that was probably in the 40s.
When 1943.
Yeah. When he was assigned, Bob Murphy was assigned to go out and get the biggest bear he could for a museum in Los Angeles. And of course, at that time, they were killing coyotes. The rangers themselves were assigned to get rid of the bad animals, and they were even smashing pelican eggs because the pelicans would eat the fish, and they wanted more fish for the people.
It seems crazy now, you know, things that were happening 60, 70 years ago, but I guess it was normal.
Yeah.
Well, there's a passage about Yellowstone's animals and the tourists that I'd like you to read. But before you do, tell us who William Tazinski and Brigitte Frendenhaugen are.
William Tazinski was a photographer who was taking pictures in the park and came upon a grizzly who was busy eating, and he apparently ignored the signals that she gave and kept getting closer and closer with a not very long telephoto lens. And so she attacked him and killed him. Brigitte was hiking, backpacking alone. And in that situation, people said that it was the first time they'd really been aware that a bear would stalk a human just because she was small and alone. And the bear also, in that situation, a different bear, killed her and ate her. Visitors often treated Yellowstone as a giant zoo. When I worked as an interpretive ranger, I tried to convey the difference. One day, a camper rushed up to me in my ranger uniform and said excitedly, "There's a buffalo near my tent in Bridge Bay Campground." I replied, "Yes, that's right. They live there. Be very careful." I struggled daily to find a balance between giving muted cautionary advice and terrifying people with tales of dangerous animals. Some arrived too frightened to venture far from their cars. Others grilled us for ideas on how they could meet a grizzly face to face. They seemed to long for the adrenaline rush of terror. I could understand that. Winston Churchill said, "Nothing in life is so exhilarating as to be shot at without result." Yellowstone was one of the few places where a person could still feel fully alive. I felt infuriated by those who openly sought bear encounters. One man bragged to me about cooking steak to bait bears near Pelican Valley in hopes of taking better photographs. As Tazinski demonstrated, the stakes were higher in Yellowstone than for more prosaic adventures such as bungee jumping. A bear may have died as a result of Tazinski's hunger for an outstanding grizzly photograph. If my pedantic words made no impression, sometimes I wish the thrill seekers could read the ranger's journal about Brigitte's death. Maybe then they would learn about respecting Yellowstone through the ranger's agonized soul-searching. Forced to deal too often with the grisly effects of poor judgment, the staff at the Lake Hospital developed a dark sense of humor. Each spring, they competed to guess the date of the first person gored by a bison. One year, their staff t-shirt read, "A message to the traveler from Yellowstone Park Medical Services. You have every right to indulge yourself in Yellowstone. So feed the bears, pet the moose, let your children ride the buffalo, swim in the boiling hot mineral pools, drive fast, pass on curves. These messages from the folks who really care. Yellowstone Park Medical Services. We want your business."
I guess that's one way to deal with the ignorance. So whatever happened to Lori? How long did she work in the park? And where did she go?
Lori got a promotion. The Park Service sent her to get trained as a sewer plant operator. And so she got that training. She worked for a while in the park. And then she moved to Havre, Montana.
Do you still keep in touch with her?
Yeah.
That was an inspiring story. Lori came to the park 100 pounds overweight and not sure of her ability to do her job, and she developed a profession out of that experience.
She did. I really admired her. She was terrified of heights when she, which she didn't realize when she took the job.
Cleaning off roofs.
Cleaning off roofs.
What else would you like to talk about in the book? We're just about out of time, but we have a few minutes if there's anything else you want to say.
Well, everybody I knew was transformed by the experience. And I would say the changes that I experienced, I got a little better at snowmobiling. I developed some skills, but I also developed a reluctance to be quite as self-righteous as I was when I arrived. I used to hate snowmobiling, and then I became a snowmobiler. And so that was one change. The other was that living as intimately as that with people we didn't necessarily have anything in common with, we had to learn how to get along just to help each other survive and sustain one another emotionally as well as potentially physically.
Marjane Ambler lives in Atlantic City, Wyoming and Lake Havasu, Arizona. Look for more information about her and the book, as well as links to our podcast and Facebook page at mtpr.org/twq. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.